All right. Well, greetings, everyone. Nice to see you. I will start by going around and greeting folks, starting with Yeshe Itoki and Mark, Linda R, Alex, Andy, Shoketsu, Bob K, Phil, Marv, and Cam. Cam is good. Okay. Pat, Paulette, Karen, Betty, Erica, Peter, Katie, Ryugen, Brian, Amelia, Jim, Sabrina, Ruth Ann, and so on. Okay. Let's see. Trying to think of what we have in terms of announcements. Tuesday study series is on the 9 fields of Zen practice. I don't know. Can anybody else think of anything that is coming up or I should mention?
Founders Day soon.
Founders Day, yeah. That will be in place of our regular chanting service. I believe whatever's kind of closest to September 19th or so, because that's when Kyogen Carlson died, one of my teachers. So we do a founders ceremony on that day. So keep an eye out for that. There'll be an announcement in the newsletter about it too. And let's see, yesterday we had the term student opening retreat and two of us were in the Zendo. The remaining folks were on Zoom. And it was just so nice to be there that I'm planning, and you know how COVID plans go. But, you know, what I would like to do is open the Zendo to fully vaccinated folks who have like submitted their card with a maximum of 10 people mid-October. So that's kind of my plan. And I imagine that at first there's not going to be very many people there, you know, but you know, it feels like we gotta just kind of get the Zendo going again, and I don't know, be nice to maintain it. Feels kind of neglected. So yeah, stay tuned for that. That's just about, so Delta variant is like really bad right now, but the pattern it usually goes is that then it starts to go down. So Yeshe Itoki.
Will you also be requiring masks?
I'm guessing so at this point. That'll still be fully masked and social distance. So like the 10 seats are like, so we're down to 10 seats plus the teacher's seat, but like they're really spaced out. All right. Any questions or anything? Right. So today I had the darndest time deciding what to talk about. Sometimes it's just like, Dharma talk block, you know, it was just like, I don't know, I guess Eightfold Path. I don't know. Like, it just, what should I talk about? So what I decided to do was look at the first chapter of Kyogen's book, You Are Still Here. And that was great. Cause I think, you know, as a teacher, you get, your mind just goes in certain patterns and there's certain like a limited number of ideas and topics occur to you. And it's kind of nice when you just, you know, read something else and, oh yeah, that's an interesting track to go down. So today's talk is on bodhicitta, or way-seeking mind, which is what Kyogen calls his chapter. So bodhicitta, bodhi means awakening or enlightenment, and citta means mind. So bodhicitta is awakening mind or the mind of enlightenment, and you might say it's enlightened mind, but it's also the mind that we say, like, in a way you wouldn't even have the urge toward enlightenment if you didn't already have some aspect of that in you. So the mind that seeks awakening is already, in a way, the awakened mind. And then, just for comparison, the bodhisattva means a being. So a bodhisattva is an awakening being or an awakened being, which is, in Mahayana Buddhism, what we're aspiring to. So I decided to turn to one of our main Mahayana sources on bodhicitta, which is Shantideva, Way of the Bodhisattva. So he has a whole chapter on bodhicitta. I'm going to share a little bit of it with you. So he says, speaking of bodhicitta, as when a flash of lightning rends the night, and in its glare shows all the dark black clouds had hid. Likewise, rarely through the Buddha's power, virtuous thoughts rise, brief and transient in the world. Thus behold the utter frailty of goodness. Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing able to withstand the great and overwhelming strength of evil. Those who wish to overcome the sorrows of their lives and put to flight the pain and sufferings of beings, those who wish to win such great beatitude should never turn their back on bodhicitta. Should bodhicitta come to birth in one who suffers in the dungeons of samsara, the world of suffering, in that instant he is called the Buddha's heir, worshipful alike to gods and men. For like the supreme substance of the alchemists, it takes the impure form of human flesh and makes it the priceless body of a Buddha. Such is bodhicitta. We should grasp it firmly. So what is this bodhicitta that arises, that redeems us, that turns into the way-seeking mind that Kyogen talks about? And as I was saying, we see it as, it's the mind that seeks awakening, and it is the awakened mind simultaneously. And this is one of my favorite descriptions of this comes from, this is Houston Smith, Why Religion Matters, one of my favorite books. And he says, the finitude, finite as opposed to infinite, the finitude of mundane existence cannot satisfy the human heart completely. Built into the human makeup is a longing for a more that the world of everyday experience cannot requite. This outreach strongly suggests the existence of something that life reaches for, in the same way that the wings of birds point to the reality of air. So in Kyogen's book, in the first chapter, let's see, he defines, you know, how this bodhicitta manifests in us, at least in one way. He calls it an intuition brings someone to practice with questions, what is really going on here? What's the deeper meaning of my existence? Can this teaching lead to the answer? These first stirrings are called the way-seeking mind. When we clarify it to affirm resolve, it becomes the thought of enlightenment. It becomes bodhicitta. So from the Buddhist point of view, what we should feel is gratitude for the way-seeking mind, not pride. What causes it to arise? We don't know. What makes us start looking for something more, or seeking growth, or forming aspirations? And as we look around us, I don't know if it's necessarily fair to say there are people who don't have the mind that seeks the way, maybe, but it can be very, very dormant. But we have this sense, and this is why, in a way that Buddhism doesn't proselytize, is that in a sense you make the Dharma available so that if somebody, the way-seeking mind arises in someone, they can find it, they can come and practice. But you can't make that way-seeking mind arise in them. That is something that's kind of like a seed, and it might be dormant, but it hasn't sprouted yet. So there's no accounting for when and where and in whom the way-seeking mind has arisen. And sometimes this can be helpful way to think of things in order to have more patience for people. When you recognize, you know, on their path, this seed has not sprouted yet, but it might at any time. So this way-seeking mind, this aspiration, this looking for something more, is critical to our practice, but it also can be kind of tricky. And that's what Kyogen's chapter is about a little bit. So when we have this sense, there's got to be something more, it actually kind of springs from a sort of dissatisfaction. You know, what more is this? Is it possible for me to grow, to get free of some of this suffering, etc.? But then if our self gets involved in that seeking, you know, what are we seeking? It can actually, that sense of seeking can actually end up being a source of dissatisfaction. We have a sense of a need for improvement, or certain kinds of achievements or understanding or progress, or maybe we conclude we aren't making any progress. So, you know, that's our ordinary sense of self getting involved in this idea that now we are seeking the way. So Kyogen talks about being at the monastery, and, you know, I mean, he has put everything in his life aside. He's in his early 20s, he's gone to this monastery, he's gotten ordained, he's been given it his all, meditating hard. And so, you know, the way that the mind that seeks the way has really arisen, right? He's going for it. But then he ends up having an issue with his teacher, a conflict with his teacher, and it calls everything into doubt. And he describes, you know, during this time of crisis, I questioned everything. What am I doing here? What is this all about? Why do this? Once we ask why, the question can suck everything into it, like a black hole. Why do this one thing becomes, why do anything? Why take the next breath? Why am I here at all? When we compare one decision with all the other options, all other possible decisions, we enter the black hole of doubt. Why do anything? When we only perceive the dependent dimension, as I've been talking about, aka the relative, the dimension of time and space and causation, bodhicitta can seem quite frail, quite small in this world of, you know, full of greed, hate, and delusion, war, oppression, poverty, division, hatred, lies, suspicion, self-absorption, resistance to actions for the common good. You know, it begins to feel like, you know, is there any hope for humanity? Can good triumph over evil? You know, the bodhicitta can seem quite small. And certainly if we're thinking about our own relationship to our own practice, and we're not making the progress we want to make, or maybe we have, like, we've kind of, for many of us, we come to practice and it really helps us get over some of our most difficult issues. Or maybe not over, but it gives us a way to really live with and cope with our most difficult issues. But then what? You know, why keep practicing? Why keep going? All right, good enough. So then the mind that seeks the way, can the bodhicitta can kind of fizzle a little bit. And certainly if we face any kind of challenges and doubts like Kyogen, you know, a betrayal of a teacher, or, you know, our spiritual community ends up dysfunctional or something like that, it can be, you know, a setback to that aspiration. So why keep doing anything? So Kyogen says, talks about another way to relate to bodhicitta besides the dependent dimension of improving or learning or, you know, achieving good in the world and stuff like that. He says, during this time of questioning at the monastery, I started reading the Diamond Sutra. I was struck by this quote from the Diamond Sutra. The Buddha is saying, moreover, Subhuti, a bodhisattva who gives a gift should not be supported by a thing, nor should he be supported anywhere. When he gives gifts, he should not be supported by sight objects, nor by sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. For Subhuti, the bodhisattva, the great being, should give gifts in such a way that he is not supported by the notion of a sign. So Kyogen says, not supported in this passage means to do something without an expectation of getting something back. Mind objects are self-constructions, underlying assumptions about the way the world works. The Diamond Sutra is saying that dana, true generosity, has to come to a place beyond all of that, from unconditioned mind itself. And to me, this passage referred to my own offering of my practice and my service. To truly give this as dana, it would have to come from a place that did not depend on anything external. That meant for me, it shouldn't matter what my teacher did or didn't say, or how anybody reacted. Instead, my practice had to come from a place in the core of my being that arose in spite of any of those things. He says, when a seed sprouts, it does so in the dark, down under the ground where it is wet. Without fail, the shoot goes up and the root goes down. It does this without any external prompting other than gravity and the warmth of the earth. The motivation is innate in the seed itself. True aspiration and all real practice come from this place. It is intrinsic. And in the same way that grass has the power to break up concrete and shatter rocks, it can shatter habit energy and shift the whole earth. This aspiration, or mind that seeks the way, sprouting from this intrinsic place despite conditions, will shatter our false conceptions, and it is the only thing that can really change the world. So bodhicitta, in the Buddhist cosmology, if you will, rarely arises in living beings. It's considered very rare. And one of the ways of looking at this is through the lens of the six realms, which I've talked about before, and I have a couple podcasts on. So in Buddhist cosmology, there's, and you don't have to take this literally at all. I think of this as more just kind of, you know, the richness of myth and metaphor. So it's not just heaven and hell. There's actually six realms. There's a heaven, there's a hell, there's a human realm, there's the realm of the fighting demigods, there's the beast realm, and the realm of the hungry ghosts. And basically each of those realms, except for the human realm, in the heaven realm, beings, and you can kind of look around just in the world and see these different kinds of beings. In the heaven realm, things are just so pleasant that the way-seeking mind doesn't arise. It's like, eh, it's all good. And sometimes we're there, right? Everything's pretty good. No need to, you know, put in forth any effort. In the fighting demon or fighting demigod realm, you're just too wrapped up in acquisition and competition. In the beast realm, you're just focused on your own sensual pleasure and safety, food, sex, whatever. It's all just very, very small reality. Hell, you are just too consumed with hatred to be able to concentrate on spiritual practice. And the hungry ghost realm is, you know, you're longing for something that you can't find, and you're not looking for it in the right places. But in the human realm, it's said we have just the right combination of things. Just, you know, it's not so hellish. It's not so wonderful. There's just enough discontent for us to, for the way-seeking mind to arise. And what, you know, once again, what is it? It's difficult to wrap words around it. It's because it's, you know, it defies that kind of thing, right? Is it aspiration, desire for growth, you know, exploration of what you don't yet know, wanting to be benefit beings, grow in skillfulness, give them things? Seeking liberation. And how does it manifest in our lives? I mean, what are you still trying to learn or develop in yourself? In what ways are you still trying to grow? In what ways are you trying to cultivate greater wisdom, greater compassion, greater skillfulness with beings? Do you teach others beneficial things, take care of others, give service? Do you create and share beauty in the world, work for positive change? So try to think of those things that you would do no matter what happened, no matter how, what state of the world, if went to hell in a handbasket, you would still do these things. These are the things that, you know, come from that unconditioned place Kyogen was talking about. And when we feel discouraged, when it feels like the forces of the world are just, you know, the forces of good are overshadowed by greed, hate, and delusion, and all of that, and things seem pointless, then we can shift our attention from that dependent dimension, which we don't know. We don't know how it's going to turn out. Sometimes it doesn't look good. But if we shift it to the independent dimension, which is, it's not dependent on space and time, it's right here, right now, that's where things can be redeemed and transformed instantly by this bodhicitta. So Shantideva talks about this in those verses that I read. Should bodhicitta come to birth in one who suffers in the dungeons of samsara? In that instant, he is called the Buddha's heir. For like the supreme substance of the alchemists, it takes the impure form of human flesh and makes it the priceless body of the Buddha. And another thing that we'd say is there without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. Buddhas are like sentient beings who woke up by definition. So they're not otherworldly kind of beings. They are sentient beings who have this aspiration, and it's not dependent on it, you know, achieving some certain thing or some level of progress or something, just that aspiration, just that way that seeks the mind arises. And this makes me think of that movie that many of you have probably seen, Life is Beautiful. So it's a story of it's funny and it's terribly sad and everything. So it's based on some real stories of survivors of concentration camps, but it's a made up story. But a father and his son end up in the concentration camp, and you know, it's terrible. But the son is only, I don't know, 6 maybe, and the father does everything that he can to make his son think this is a game. And so it's just like so heartwarming the way that he, you know, he plays around and he like goofs around. He's a kind of humorous guy. So he makes his son think that this is just a game, even when it leads up to the father's death. Like, he's just like, hey, off I go. And, you know, thereby, of course, then the son is not as traumatized as he would have been otherwise. But it's this example of, you know, here is the worst, most horrible manifestation of human beings that we know of. And yet in the middle of that is this beauty and this service and this love. So when I think about, you know, where is the evidence of bodhicitta in the world? I think about our Saturday Sangha check-ins after meditation, when people just check in about their life and practice. And it's so remarkable how every person has something interesting to teach, something interesting to share from their own direct experience. As you see this bodhicitta operating in people's lives as they open to it and explore. I see it in, you know, people showing up this morning. This is bodhicitta in action. Obviously, great acts of courage and service. I don't know about all of you, but I feel like the bodhicitta is just palpable in hospitals. Just when you just go into that space, and everything in this space is aimed at caring for suffering beings in the most fundamental way. And that is just so, I mean, hospitals are kind of awful and places you don't want to be, but they're also these manifestations of this. And also for me, I feel like I taste this manifesting in the world when I listen to live music. I feel like, you know, this is an evidence of human redemption. We do some horrible, horrible stuff. But here's this, just this, this offering, this creation that comes from, you know what, it serves no practical purpose, right? It is just a celebration. It's just something, it's such an expression of this, I think, bodhicitta. So I wanted to, before we get into a discussion, Q&A, I wanted to ask people to just take, you know, 3 minutes. Hopefully you have paper next to you, but maybe not. But just take 3 minutes to think of how you manifest bodhicitta in your life. And I encourage you not to be overly humble about this. You know, it wasn't, we don't want to boast, but really to look at it through the lens of like, where do you try to make this kind of offering, allow this kind of pure expression to come through you? And it may be in very, very small ways. So I'll just give you a few minutes. All right. Did people get some ideas? I hope that we will. I would like to hear some of them. But if you have any comments or questions about the topic as a whole, certainly feel free to throw those in as well. Anybody a little bit surprised by being able to find things in your life that manifest this? So,
I had a quick question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So I know you talked about like adding beauty to the world is one. What about like when you just appreciate beauty. Does that count, or is that just like separate?
I don't know. What do people think? I mean, because Kyogen talked in his chapter about his practice being a gift. So, yeah, I don't know. But maybe some other folks will weigh in on that. My mind tends to be like very organized. Like, well, you're giving, you're receiving, but do me. So now I'm kind of like, what? I don't know. I guess so. Phil.
I figured out about 3 years ago that most of my suffering was from trying to get other people to do things they don't want to do. So I'm working on not doing that, and that's my gift. So.
Ah. Yeah, it reminds me of the Chosen Bays, who says, you know, the Bodhisattva vow to free all beings, like primarily you're freeing them from you. Peter.
Thank you. I am wanting to say that on the topic of liking beauty versus creating beauty, it rings as, you know, how much do I like fighting climate change versus how much do I actually fight climate change? And I do think that we do need to be in action. I'm just going to say there's no substitute for putting it out there, for being in action. And in my particular way, I loved Life is Beautiful when it came out in 1999. And I love the word play. To me, playing is doing something without in order to, and just putting it out there. And I found that guy very playful before he had a mission. For the first half of the movie, this guy was entirely playful.
Sweet. So on. And then so on, and then Ruth Ann.
Well, actually, to respond to Erica's question, you know, it's like people create art, create music. It's like if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, did it make a sound? You know, so without people to appreciate art and music, you know, what is the point of art and music? So appreciating beauty, I don't know if you can call blues music beauty, but
I would
appreciating. But you know, when people express appreciation, it really is a gift to the artist. But what I was going to say that surprised me was, you know, I've been railing about these damn unvaccinated conspiracy theory people and these, yeah, and just go get vaccinated, you whiners. And then there's a friend of mine who's this big cuddly guy, you know, he's got big round bellies, he's a big bearish guy. And you know, he was expressing this anti-vax stuff, but he's a friend of mine and he's been a supporter of mine for a long time. And so I just thought, you know what, maybe I'll just message him. Maybe I'm the only person that's going to say this to him. And I just said, look, man, I've known you forever. I love you. You're a big guy. You're a big cuddly guy like my husband is. And, you know, I see these images from ICUs and there's all these big guys in there, you know, with the tubes and stuff. It's like, you are vulnerable, man. And I love you. And I really hope you'll consider getting vaccinated. And I kind of surprised myself. I was like, instead of going, what the hell is wrong with you? Don't you know you can die? Yeah. So I surprised myself. I tapped into the loving feeling that I had for this human being. And it allowed me to let all that go. So that surprised me.
Ruth Ann.
In Zen and the American Grain, Tolkien talks about that certain amount of certainty within us, that which part of you is appreciating beauty? It's that a bigger self, for a lack of a better word right here, but that's what's appreciating beauty. And we don't have to explain why. We are just in that moment, which gives us, it's just life affirming. I'm glad for that question and all of this. The small things we do, when I listen without agenda, I know that I'm in a good space, as part of the Buddha path. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Shizuki.
To the question about appreciating beauty, that I think it's a form of expression of gratitude and perhaps also respect and reverence. And the beauty, the poetry, the word, the glint of sunlight on a leaf in the dark woods, whatever it is there. But many people might walk right by it. The person who is touched by it, has opened themselves up to be touched by it, I think feels, is allowing gratitude to come in. And so to me, that is also a form of bodhicitta. It's a receptivity. That's all.
Thank you. I wanna hear some of people's ways that you manifest bodhicitta. Linda.
So one thing I like to do, there's my dog, her foster mom, we adopted our dog like 7 years ago, but I keep in touch with her foster mom. And so every now and then, like a couple weeks ago, I went to the Dahlia farm in Canby, Oregon, and I bought 3 big bouquets of dahlias. And so I like to do a drop and dash on her doorstep with stuff sometimes. So I left flowers for her, and then I'll email her and say, check your doorstep. So I like to do that. And then one of the bunches of flowers went to someone in our neighborhood who had their car vandalized in their driveway. And then the next day had it vandalized at Forest Park. So I brought that family a bunch of dahlias. Then the other thing that I've been doing is I'm mentoring a 7-year-old boy who's in foster care. And I think I'm getting just as much out of it or more than he is. But I mean, he's getting a lot out of it. He said to me a few weeks ago that you're the best thing in my life. So, I mean,
oh.
I mean, we're both getting something out of it for sure, you know, but just being a weekly present, patient force for him, you know, is really good for both of us, I think.
Sweet. So, thank you for sharing.
Yeah. I'll go. I couldn't raise my hand. This is Amelia. I'm actually doing something right now that I'm finding very, it feels important in a lot of ways. There's a group, there's a nonprofit, a local nonprofit that helps resettles refugees in the Portland area. It's called the Refugee Care Collective. And they've been doing this for years. And of course, things trickled down to almost nothing during the Trump years. And now there are more refugees coming to Portland, and especially some coming from Afghanistan. And it's a group I give financially, which is probably maybe the most efficient way to do the most good, I guess. But they also have something that they do. They collect, they call them restart kits that people can put together. They're boxes of, you can put together kitchen, they give you a list, you can put together kitchen items, bedding, personal care. There's even a little welcome kit you can put together. And then they have a big collection point where everybody brings their containers that they've, you know, their big plastic bins that they've put together with these restart kits. And I've done it before, and I'm doing it again for the next pickup. And I do it with my granddaughters. And there's something, I realize in some sense it's sort of selfish because I find it so personally enriching. But it's such, there's something about the physical act of knowing that you are immediately making someone's life better. And I take my list to Target or Bed Bath & Beyond or whatever, and the feeling is I'm not going to buy the cheap stuff. Just visualizing what it would be to be just coming in from the Ukraine or Somalia or Afghanistan and being a refugee and opening this box. And there's a little handmade note from someone's grandchildren saying, we're glad you're here and welcome. And finding that someone cared enough to really, really welcome you with things that they would want to have, you know, things I'd want to have in my own home. And to know, to let them know that they are, they're worthwhile and they are welcomed. And I don't know. I there are a lot of causes I support, but I always find it seems there's something about the physical act of doing something physically and investing the mental and spiritual and emotional energy into it of visualizing the person on the other end of that. That is, it's just so, I keep putting it in this selfish kind of way of saying it's so rewarding, but it just feels like you are doing something unqualifiedly, whatever the word is, good, that's for the betterment of something. And
I'm so
thankful for that.
You make me think about the, you know, we say that the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And we all find this, right? When we're really participating in this open way, you know, the question, like we were saying, is it creation of beauty, appreciation of beauty, giving, receiving? We benefit when we give. Eugen.
Thanks, Domio. So I work at the provincial legislature in Edmonton. I'm a committee clerk, and so my job is to sort of be a, not exactly a referee, but a linesman in, for the two major competing parties in the legislature at the committee level, and you know, to serve as a as the procedural administrative officer. And Alberta is one of probably the most partisan jurisdictions in the country. The two main parties, one is very conservative and the other is quite quite liberal. And so there's a lot of tension that can go on in the committee room, which kind of spills over into dialogue, discussion, and decision making. And so one of the things that I try to do is, before the beginning of every meeting, try to find some way to a common thread between the members, a joke, something that's happened, try and bring something out where they're actually start talking to each other before the meeting about something that doesn't have anything to do with the meeting. And selfishly, because there is a selfish aspect, it tends to lower the temperature of the meeting and makes my job a little bit easier, but it also tends to lower the temperature in the room throughout the meeting. And I mean, I don't know if they make any better decisions or anything, but I mean, at least they're not, you know, harvesting each other's organs throughout it. So it makes it a little bit, makes the dialogue a little bit better. So that's my story. Thank you.
Yeah. I think this can show up in so many different ways. You know, on my list was showing up. Just showing up regularly for practice. Because there's something deep and important about practice, and somebody needs to show up and kind of keep the thread going. And offering my ideas on the podcast, for example. Like when I first did that, I'm like, who the hell wants to listen to me? Like what? You know, I didn't know and know whether people would find this useful, or I don't know. This is just me writing and going off. I don't know. But so it's just like this offering, and it's created some benefit. And I feel like manifesting of bodhicitta is also my, it's ironic because we're looking to be completely satisfied with our lives, but also not. So it's like, at a certain level, we want to be satisfied, right? We want to be able to touch that independent dimension and just realize, you know, there is no place else to go. But if we get the self involved and conceive of, I am good enough, you know, like there's a satisfaction that we can create that is just kind of stagnant. And, you know, it's very easy for somebody, you know, if you achieve a certain amount in your life, if you say become a Zen teacher, you've been a Zen teacher for 10 years and you can just figure like, I understand the Dharma, I'm good. When it's like, you don't, the Dharma is infinite. There are teachers who understand so much more than I do, and I could practice for lifetimes and still be learning more and discovering more. So I feel like that is a manifestation of bodhicitta as well. Brian.
So at work right now, we're completely in the soup. You know, we're flailing, we're overwhelmed, it's a total mess. And it's lots of different groups of people who, you know, can get mad at each other because of this, that, you know, everyone's frustrated and feeling pressured and so forth. So I think my contribution is that I exude confidence that we will succeed. And partly I define success as doing everything that we can do, nothing more and nothing less. So we're not, the fact that things are a mess, we're not going to underachieve, and we're not going to hold ourselves to an impossible standard that can't be achieved. So, you know, but I'm like everybody else. I can't, it's hard to maintain this joyful effort, that mood kind of consistently. So this is helpful because this is sustaining that. Because I do think it's a good thing. I think it helps us be what we can be and so forth. But, you know, when I'm able to do that, I feel like I am most kind of exhibiting that, you know, bodhicitta, the you know, joyful effort. And when I'm wavering, you know, I feel like I'm casting around looking for the, you know, source of support that will enable me to keep on that track. So.
And that's where, like, the essence of, you know, Kyogen's chapter was this idea that this bodhicitta comes from nowhere. You know, it's this unconditioned thing, an unconditional thing. So it's just, you know, that positivity that you are pulling up, it's just, it's coming out of your gut. It's not because you like, well, let's see, we're probably going to be okay. Like, it's not like you calculated the likelihood that you guys will work things. It's just, this seems like the way to be. It just, this seems like the way to.
And it's also whenever you're at this fork where you could go to conflict or you could go, you know, it's staying rooted in what we're trying to do. And if somebody flubs something, you know, trying to keep focused on, you know, the 90% of it that was right or the 65% of it that was right or the 10% of it that was right. Anyway, something, some portion of it that was right. And, you know, keep plowing ahead. So.
So I hope that, I don't know, I hope that managed to convey the kind of hope. I guess, I mean, hope is, it's an unconditional hope or positivity or something that this teaching of bodhicitta invites us to have, that it doesn't matter what the circumstances are or what they become. But when we, you know, when we have this, something arises out of bodhicitta, it's beautiful and pure and unconditional. It is an offering that comes from the core of our being. And this is just beautifully redemptive. Like the story of the, you know, like dahlias showing up on your porch when, like, twice in a row you're caught, you know, like, oh, that is, you know, the world is giving you some crap. But, you know, here's some bodhicitta that can just, you know, sweeten the deal. So I will end with our verse then. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.